CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
The CoinWorld Podcast is delighted to be back for another episode today. I'm Jeff Stark.
And I'm Larry Jewett. And we promised you on a recent episode, we've got a great guest in store for you. And we're going to deliver on that promise here today as we spend some time with Kenneth Rendell. And if you're not familiar with him, by the end of the interview, you'll begin to understand the amount of work that this gentleman has put in and the benefits that have come from it. So we invite you to stick around and listen to what we have. And great job, Jeff, getting Mr. Rendell to show up for the podcast here. He's been on some of the national networks here lately. Just saw where Dennis Tucker put out a press release on social media about this. And we're very fortunate to get a guest of this caliber. So thanks for the effort.
Oh, hey, so fortunate and glad to do it. The book was amazing. There were so many stories that Mr. Rendell told in the book, and we tried to get some of those stories in the interview, and we could only scratch the surface of, you know, just the tiniest of amounts, because it's a very compelling book, very interesting book. This is a guy who has been involved in some of the in authenticating or I guess debunking some of the greatest forgeries and famous papers from the Hitler diaries to the Salamander, White Salamander letter from the Mormon Church hoax, and he was involved in some purported documents of Elvis and official real documents of Martin Luther King and Richard Nixon, and on and on and on. It's really a fascinating read, and we'll get into that more in just a little bit.
Yeah, and it's been great to have the opportunity to see the book, and encourage everybody to do the same, because it's very interesting indeed. Doing a lot of reading here lately, doing a lot of buying up on the platforms, just kind of keeping business as usual here. And, it's just been great to know that the idea is to educate. And that's one of the purposes of our podcast here, is to educate and to inform. And there are so many different ways that you can learn. And, I think about some of the local coin club meetings. And I know you've mentioned it on several occasions where you go there, but just thinking about the work that's being done, because these are the people that get together sometimes in a very small environment and, really begin to strengthen up. There's strength in numbers here. And obviously, if you're not a member of a coin club, a national coin club, a local coin club, we always encourage you to do that. I'm just going to declare October as Coin Club Month, just because. And it has no sway whatsoever, but there shouldn't have to be a special Coin Club Month. Every month should be Coin Club Month.
Yeah, I mean, there's National Coin Week in, what, April? So you're now saying October is Coin Club Month. Hey, if you're not in a club, join a club. There's some great fun to be had by sharing the hobby with some local friends.
And I figure I have this ability because we're doing this recording on Mean Girls Day, which also happens to be National Boyfriend Day, and I still haven't figured that out. So because there is a Mean Girls Day, I thought, I wonder if there's a Nice Girls Day. And the closest I could find was Beautiful Girls Day, which is May 24th, which happened to be the birthday of my ex-wife, and that's just disputes anything that you have to offer for that one right there. So I'm going to look it up, see if there actually is a Coin Club Month or a Coin Club Day to go along with this, because you mentioned National Coin Week. In fact, National Coin Week, we talked about this year how special it was, and was doing some looking back in history and found out that the first National Coin Week was, in fact, in 1924. So we know that it has a significant anniversary coming up when we do it again coming in April. But let's not look too far into the future. Let's look at the present. Better yet, let's look at the past.
Yeah, let's go do the This Week in Numismatic History. There's this is, as I'm want to do, a two-parter, and I'll do the more recent thing first. This is for you. We're going to October 6, 1992. That was when Congress authorized the Special Olympics commemorative dollar. I know there's a lot of folks in the hobby that maybe aren't pleased with the, I think it's Eunice Kennedy Shriver image on the coin, the fact that there was a living person and she's not, say, as speaking of beautiful girls, she's not a depiction of liberty that we're used to seeing, for sure. But I know it has special meaning for your family, so I call that out as one of the things I wanted to focus on. But I also use that day from 1967, something nefarious happened that day, because that was when armed gunmen robbed Willis H. DuPont of his some of his numismatic collection, and that will come in to play in just a little bit. That's a that was a big event in, you know, the 1960s, and that was a story that continued on even into the 80s and the present, perhaps. So it's a reminder of a need to be vigilant when thinking about security. So that's This Week in Numismatic History.
Well, very good. I appreciate that. And yes, indeed, the Special Olympics coin did have, and it was a purchase that we were one of the first ones we were able to make recently, and it holds a place of honor around here. So, yeah, I totally agree. There was some, obviously, some controversy back when the coin was issued, because the idea of putting a living person on it, especially one that didn't necessarily have the national notice and the reason behind it and all, but, you know, hindsight's 20/20, as they say. So it's just kind of neat that we have that in our collection now, and it's very prominent in our collection. So
very good. So
I don't want to talk about me anymore. Let's talk about you. Let's talk about somebody else.
Well, let's continue the story of the Willis DuPont robbery. When we're looking at This Week in Numismatic History, I'm sorry, This Week in Coin World History, we chose the 1983 year because that was the year that Mr. Rendell was involved in debunking the Hitler hoax. And it turned out that in October 5th issue of 1983, there was an update to that Willis DuPont robbery story. The headline reads, "Jury finds not guilty in 1804 dollar case." The meat of the article is that a federal district court jury returned a not guilty verdict in the trial of one of two Las Vegas men charged in Denver federal court with the interstate transportation of one of two 1804 silver dollars stolen in the 1967 Coconut Grove, Florida DuPont robbery. The Denver federal district judge also dismissed the prosecutor's case against the second man. Well, the story is that the Class 3 Linderman and the Class 1 Cohen specimens of the 1804 dollar were both taken in the robbery on October 5th, 1967, when five masked gunmen entered the Florida home of DuPont, son of longtime collector Lamont DuPont. And these gunmen held the DuPont family and servants at gunpoint while the loot was grabbed up, including the aforementioned 1804 dollars and a Brasher doubloon. So just thought that was interesting that it happened that way, that we saw an update to the story by looking at This Week in Coin World History. So that was, you always look for these through lines, and to me that was an interesting through line, if you will, a continuation in the news.
It's neat that that happens that way. Looking on the letters page here, number one, first thing that took my eye was the editorial cartoon, and made me realize sometimes how much I miss these editorial cartoons. Showed a man talking to a lady across the table, and he said, "I do not always talk coins. Sometimes I talk paper money." And I go, "Yeah, word, I got that." You know, I'm working one of the projects working off air, and that is the dealer directory, our 2024 Coin World dealer directory, just about ready to go to print. So we've been doing a lot of thinking, a lot of talking about dealers. There's a couple of letters in the October 5th, 1983 issue that dealt with dealers. First one says, under the headline of Salutes Dealers, "This letter is a salute to the coin dealers of America. Over the 20 years that I've been collecting coins, the American coin dealer has shown the greatest interest in helping me personally in finding those many rare and not so rare coins needed to complete my collections. Since youth, all have gone out of their way to either acquire or talk of coins. Though my collection is limited because of financial conditions, there had been many a time in which the dealers have waited patiently for those few dollars that I forwarded to them. Even during the late 70s and early 80s, when criticism was very swift, almost all dealers were willing to work with a collector, and in many cases at a little lower price. Again, I wish to extend my thanks to those many dealers that have made the hobby enjoyable." Right below that is, that was from Dominic Motters of Wildwood, New Jersey. But right below that, there was one that says, "Resents statement." And it starts off, "First, as a stamp and coin dealer and as a collector, I resent Palmbury's statement that coin dealers have priced the collector out of the market with their ridiculous prices. One receives what one pays for, but I will agree there are some dealers. I do agree that the prices of the Olympic coins are too high. I bought my dollars at $24 only because I did want to support our Olympic team, but I absolutely refused to buy any 1983 proof sets at their ridiculously high price for these coins. Second, with reference to the above, I feel the 1983 S-list proof sets were injected into the marketplace to add impetus to their purchase from the Mint. In this day and age of high technology, it seems highly unlikely that something as obvious as a mint mark could have been left off the coins with no one noticing their absence. Finally, and more important, I most definitely feel that the Mint should melt all of those ugly Ike and SBA dollars that they're holding at our expense and produce a dollar-sized dollar with the Statue of Liberty depicted in all of her glory, and that the greatest part of her seniorage should go toward the rehabilitation of the famous lady." A little bit ahead of time there. "Unlike Ike or SBA, the Statue of Liberty means something to people in every walk of life in every part of the world, free or otherwise. She is a symbol of freedom, strength, and charity, three things that make the USA the greatest country in the world, and why the greatest country has the ugliest coinage is truly beyond belief. If not a dollar or half dollar, the Statue of Liberty would be an excellent subject for this country's 1 ounce gold bullion coin, not a metal, or a $50 gold coin that would sell for and be worth $50, containing approximately 1/10 of an ounce of gold. I put about $3,000 worth of Ike dollars into circulation, and they were accepted. I injected about $2,000 worth of SBAs into circulation, which was not an easy task, and they were usually rejected. But a dollar-sized dollar with a rendition of the Statue of Liberty, it would be accepted, and the citizens of this great country would have something to be proud of, while the U.S. Mint would have made some huge strides. Collectors, unite. Write a letter to your congressman. He has to be good for something other than spending your money. He could be influential in producing a piece of money which we could all be proud." The letter comes from Larry Chase of New York City. Powerful. Yeah.
You just chose it because his name is Larry.
I do too. I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah, that's it right there. That's why I picked it out. I left Hans and Jane and Fred all on the sidelines while I could do a Larry letter. That's
well, Larry there had some interesting ideas, and certainly in hindsight, we see that some of those have come to fruition in some manner of speaking, if not the exact way prescribed by the letter writer. So
yeah, and time has a way of taking care of some things. The 86 renovations of the Statue of Liberty, you got the idea that the Statue of Liberty is on a dollar coin now, so you know, yeah. Just the idea that, well, you have it all right there.
Time wounds all heals.
That's what they say.
So now that I've heard the letter from you, I think it's time for you to answer a question from me.
I think it was O for September. Let's just see what happens in October.
Well, this is an expert level question. So it's a two-parter. So hopefully you can get one or two right, and that'll count for something.
Canada question.
Nope. The question last week was, what year did the Denver Mint begin striking coins for a friendly government? And what country was that for? So, two-parter, do you have any idea what the answers were? And I should say, what are the answers, or what do you think the answers to this question, these questions are?
Well, you know, at first thought, I thought something like the Philippines. But, you know, just the idea that it was, you know, there were things. And I think a lot of times when you talk about foreign governments, you think more of the San Francisco Mint than you do any of the other ones. But I'm really dancing around the fact that I don't know. I mean, I know that there were plenty of places, some of which we know better than others. And you being the world coin guy, you have that opportunity here. But I mean, if I had to go with it, you know, that's what I'd have to go with. But I don't think it was Denver that did that.
No, you're correct in that surmise, surmission. I don't know what the tense would make that. But anyway, the Denver Mint opened in 1906, I believe. And that was the first year that they started striking for other countries. And it happened to be silver, I want to say 20 centavos. And maybe the next year they did 50 centavos. But that was for Mexico. Yeah,
that would make sense. I mean, with the proximity being there, and then Mexico being a border country like that, that would make sense. I think so. I get credit for the denomination, right? But
you're 0 for October right now. But
I would say Philippines and Mexico are two different places. Yeah, you're right.
See. Although because of the Spanish influence there, because of the Spanish-American War and all that, there are certainly some, there's some connection, if you will. So you have a better chance of getting this question right because you have a copy of Safeguarding History by Kenneth Rendell, which I don't know how much you've had a chance to plow through all of it. I looked at everything, and it's a very good read, very interesting, lots of life lessons and other things. One of the events, and we didn't even get to talk to Mr. Rendell about this, that he was involved in, was debunking the Mormon letter hoax and this so-called White Salamander letter. And there's a famous story. A guy named Mark Hoffman was involved, and there was people were murdered, and it was a big thing. It was big doings. As you'll read in the book, though, Rendell is of the belief that Hoffman was not the person who actually created the fake letter, who forged the letter. He was selling the letter. So I want to know, according to the book, who was the forger of the White Salamander letter? And so that's a deep dive. It's a call for anybody who's listening to this, maybe to get a copy of the book from Whitman and find out yourself. Of course, we'll have the answer in a week. But man, what are your thoughts of the book since you received it?
It is an interesting book for sure. I mean, anybody who likes history and gets into it, you know, it's not all about coins, which that's fine. But I mean, the idea of the work that's been done, I'm sitting here trying to imagine the detail and the commitment that the author went through to make all this stuff happen. And he's a very interesting individual, just as an individual, and some of the things. And of course, he gave us a little bit of a surprise before the interview when he showed us something that was part of his collection, which I really found interesting as well. But that just drove, to me, that was the exclamation point on this individual. And certainly you're going to find a lot of interest when you buy this book, Safeguarding History.
All right. So think about that as you hear our interview right now. The Coin World podcast is delighted today to be joined by author Kenneth Rendell, who is more than just an author, an expert in documents, a dealer, a one-time coin dealer. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
So we're speaking with you today because of your new book, Safeguarding History, Trailblazing Adventures Inside the Worlds of Collecting and Forging History. But before I want to get into all the fun stuff you've done, whether that's Jack the Ripper, Adolf Hitler Diaries, some other things like that, you were a very young coin collector. It was very brief overall to your relative story, but I think some of the most interesting anecdotes come from that time. At 17 years young, you were offering pricing information for the Red Book. You're a co-founder of the Rittenhouse Society. How did this all get started with an 1806 silver half dollar?
The half dollar intrigued me. It intrigued me in terms of who had handled it. What were the people like when that half dollar was minted? They were within not that many years of the Declaration of Independence. And I really became fascinated with that direct, I saw it. And it had liberty on it. It was the new country. I found it really exciting, but I also found it exciting in terms of what I could get for it, in terms of selling it, because I really needed it. And it got me going. It was my capitalization, was that coin. And I cared about that coin enough that as soon as I was making money, going through coins in circulation, selling pennies for 10 cents, 15 cents, I bought the coin back. And the coin has been on my desk since 1903 or 54, of the symbol of how
so
I
then
started.
You're looking at the coin from 1806. You think that the experience that you had as a young person could happen today with the modern designs that we see on the coins?
To me, the simplicity of that coin was important. And it wasn't minted for people to hoard them, you know, I mean, like the state quarters, and for people, and because the government makes a lot of money, they're selling these coins for 25. I can't say, I don't really know. I know what my feeling was, and the design is simple. And the period of time interested me. I had just seen a copy of Thomas Paine's Common Sense in my history book in school, and it was water stained. And I'm sure this was inaccurate, but it was romantic that the author said probably dropped in the streets of Boston during protest riots. It connected me with people in a very interesting period. I collect type coins for the designs. So, I mean, I standing Liberty Quarter, Mercury Dime, Barber coins, St. Gaudens $20 gold pieces. And I see those as artistic, but not connecting with people of the time. I collect colonials because they're a physical symbol of people coming together, people becoming Americans before there is an America, but there were communities in the colonies and they needed coinage and they solved the problem even without great facilities by minting their own coins or buying them from England.
Let's talk a little bit more about the idea that, You've got the new book out here, and there's page after page of great information inside of here. Now, you know, you showed us earlier the first edition of Coin World. History obviously resonates well with you.
Is the endless connection between human beings. And I think that's terribly important. And I think that we're in the political mess we're in now is because people don't see they don't see other people as complex. They don't try to have any understanding. And I think if you can do it with history, then it's simpler to take what you're learning, the lessons, and apply them to today. And it also gives you a good sense of what the future will be, because underlying everything is human nature. And I think I've been very good at understanding that. And I think in a lot of the court cases, criminal, a lot of arbitration, and then all the forgery cases that I did, I was reflecting the current situation against the history of other similar situations, and it gave me a quick understanding, and in a way, a cynical attitude. I don't think everybody is good. I don't think everything is what it appears to be until you've proven that that's the case. So history for me is comforting in a way. It's very hard to apply it to today in a comforting way, but I think I've had a better understanding because I've understood people in the past.
So I want to talk about back to the coin career, your coin career. I have to say in amazement, you were able to combine coins and tourism in a sense. You had rather good timing to go to the United Kingdom, and you ended up with 6 million farthings. Can you recount that story? And I have to know how you got them all back into the U.S., or whether this was something you were creating a domestic market for there in the U.K.
No, the idea, and it was foresight, and we didn't know whether we would succeed or not, was in the United States. The English people would have just looked at farthings as their lowest denominator coin, and it'd be a small market. And we knew that one thing we had to do was to get Whitman to make blue coin boards. And that was accomplished by placing a big order for them. And and shipping them, actually, when you deal with something like coins, you think of just mailing things. But having ended up building a World War II museum, you find out you can move anything. We moved a boat from Valdez, Alaska, to Boston. And for the people who do that, it's no big deal. You know, a crane picks up the boat, puts it on the deck of a ship. When it comes off in Seattle, it goes onto the bed of a truck. And then a big crane picks it up and takes it off. And the farthings, it was just a commercial shipment. We would not have been able to ship them if it was still legal tender. There were, in those days, I don't know about now, but there were laws against exporting currency in bulk. So it was an accident that we hit on this. We read it in the paper that the following week it wouldn't be legal tender. And that helped us with the banks also, because the British pound was at $2.80. And the banks didn't want to do all the paperwork, so they was glad to sell us bulk farthings for $2 or $1.75 to the pound. So everything clicked. And my partner in this, who was just happened to be in England at the time, he had the idea that if everything failed, we could punch holes and sell these as washers. I'm not sure that that would have worked. But I mean, we did consider the melt value, you know, so that we could get something out of it. And we advertised bags of 1,000 farthings, $39.50 in Coin World. And once the coin boards were out, this came out really well. People bought them. It was something you could collect. It was raw coinage from circulation. So you had a chance to get a whole array of dates. There was only one rare date, 1956. And I suppose we hoped that there was one, at least one in every bag that went out, but we didn't do anything to alter that.
That's really, really a fun story. And that was not the first time you took traveling and bulk coin purchases to the next level. I guess one of the things that defines this period is, and it would later define a lot of your career, is the willingness to try new things.
Well, I think if I brought excitement to coin collecting. You know, I enjoy my collection now. It's on trays. Nothing is encapsulated. And because I want to see it, not through plastic. And I have a very good colonial collection in particular, and also early cents, 1793 to 95 and half cents, because I find them visually very appealing. And so I came to coin collecting not just as a business, but it genuinely was appealing and exciting to me. But when you're poor, there's a necessity also. And I had to do things other people didn't do. I had to see openings in what I could do. I had to have an edge, and the edge was service, knowledge, willingness to try things, and everything doesn't succeed. And I took chances that made sense to me, and they ended up making sense. I mean, colonial coins is something. There was one major dealer, Richard Picker in New York. And most dealers didn't know what they were, didn't know anything about them, which gave me a huge edge because all the dealers in New York had boxes marked Ken. And anything they didn't know what it was, they threw it in the box. And either they gave me the stuff or, you know, whatever I wanted to pay. And that was really helpful. I mean, I wasn't going to try to compete with $20 gold pieces. And I also have on my desk a $50 California slug, because when I was a kid, it was unthinkable to ever own a $50 gold piece. So I kept myself in the areas where I could make a difference. And doing what I did in the Caribbean, in retrospect, it's an adventure. At the time, it was physically difficult. I was taking big chances on the amount. I mean, we had hotel bills. That was a big factor. I was paying people in Jamaica because there was so much coinage in circulation and to go through it all. And I had nightmares of just coins going in front of me and flipping them over to see the date. And then they buried me in one nightmare. So I'm doing this all day long, and I couldn't escape what I was doing. But in retrospect, I mean, there were a lot of, it's interesting because your mind, I think, always filters out the bad, and you want to remember the good. I used to be a mountain climber, and I thought that factor was the most crucial fact in mountaineering, because a lot of the climbs, particularly in the winter, were absolutely miserable. And then 3 weeks later, we'd all agree to do another one like that. You know, by then we remembered the good parts only. So I think the Caribbean certainly had its bad parts, but there were a lot of things that I remember in really positive ways.
And one of those, of course, was the Hitler Diaries hoax and your participation in debunking that. You solved the hoax, which to me shows how pervasive the number of forged pieces can be, and also how the desire for a story can overwhelm the facts. You had a little Hollywood flair required as well. Can you talk about your participation in that event and then maybe how you had to make sure that you were not caught between the publisher and the other side of the equation?
It was a situation in which I really didn't have any interest in being in it, which I suppose made me more desirable on the part of Newsweek. And I continually turned them down. And then they reached me in Washington, and I was doing a lecture at the Library of Congress on forgery detection. So I was, and I also guessed what it was that they had. They wouldn't tell me anything. They want me to come to New York, sign secrecy agreements. And I rationalized on the telephone with them that it couldn't be a document that was just a sole document known to have been created. That would be a minor news story. I mean, the document is found, great, runs for one day. In order to be something that would have world importance and would be a lasting story, it had to be a journal or a diary, something that could be serialized. And there was so much secrecy involved and so much money. I said, only Hitler could command this kind of money. And then I agreed. I was lecturing at New York University on a Saturday night, and I agreed to meet them during the day. And I was hired, and this was an important distinction. I was hired by the owner of Newsweek magazine, not the editor. And that was very important because the editor really brushed me off. I mean, he had this great story and everybody had authenticated it. The only question was in what order they ran the stories. Does the Holocaust get mentioned up front? The founding of Nazism, you know, that was all of the discussion. And nobody was really paying attention to how good were the authentications. I mean, that was my job. And I prepared by going to the National Archives in Washington and making copies of all the Hitler material. The National Archives in Washington has the archives of the Third Reich. I mean, officially, that's where they went at the end of the war. And I also wanted a list of everybody who had looked at the Hitler material in the previous year, because if I was going to forge these, that's what I would do. I would go and really become very familiar with how Hitler wrote. But nobody had visited them in years. So I had all the letter formations done up on sheets of paper. So I was very prepared. What I wasn't prepared for was that the forgeries were so bad. And in initial paperwork from Stern sent to Newsweek, there were pages of handwriting, and I had no idea what it was. And I sent them back to Stern magazine and asked what were they and why did they send them? Well, they never answered. And those were pages from the Hitler Diaries. I mean, it was that far off. It never crossed my mind that these were authenticated as Hitler. And the Hitler story, like most of these, is the story of the victims. And the forger in the Hitler case, in a way, was almost pathetic. He didn't have any answers to anything. And Stern magazine gave him the answers. You know, and right at the beginning, when this is going to become a big story, Stern magazine said they had to know where they came from. And the guy said, I can't tell you. because he hadn't dreamed it up. And the Stern magazine person said, well, they must come from East Germany then. And he said, well, you know, yes. Well, how are they getting out? Well, he couldn't tell that. And they said, well, it must be a high-ranking East German official who gets them out. It was amazing. They asked the questions and provided the answers. And the guy really didn't know. I mean, he was a likable character. And he really was a character. But Stern made the whole story. And then the story of how they get it authenticated. There's a gang mentality that men have, where two men say something's okay, the third goes along with it, doesn't really question it. And that's what happened here. The people got caught up. Well, seven people have said these are genuine. I mean, you're going to go against these seven people? You know, so now eight say that it's genuine. I was concerned about what Stern was trying to do by hiring me. I mean, I proved to them it absolutely was a fraud. I mean, here was physical proof. This isn't, and a real distinction of the Hitler diaries. I was hired to prove or disprove it for the readers of Newsweek, not just say I'm Ken Rendell, this is genuine or this is a fake, but prove it so the reader sees what I see. And I did this with the editor of Stern. He agreed they were fake. He wanted to find out how it happened. But I was cynical. I thought, you know, he hires me for 2 or 3 weeks. He gets more issues of Stern out. They start getting some of their money back. And I was very concerned they would break the agreement and stretch it out. And so I worked out with the Newsweek person who represented the owner. He had the title librarian, but he was the most important person there, that he was coming to Hamburg. And at night, I would give him film of what I had worked on that day. So the whole story, Newsweek would have a backup. And if Stern confiscated or took my work papers, they'd only get what was new that day. Everything would be in the hands of Newsweek. And I had to, you know, also consider that Newsweek would double cross here or triple cross. And that Newsweek would get impatient and take everything that they had and go with the story. But knowing the print schedules for a magazine is crucial, because up to a certain point, you know, on Friday night, the information is good, but they can't use it till Saturday night when they're printing the magazine. So everything was timed out. I was just, you know, if you're in a world where you start seeing people making all kinds of mistakes, going along emotionally with things, and you're not sure of who the crooks are, you suspect everybody. And that's part of knowing history, that people are not what they necessarily appear to be.
Absolutely. And I think that offers lessons for numismatic context. You've obviously debunked numerous hoaxes. What lessons that you've employed in those debunking are something that people, listeners, can take and sort of apply into coin collecting and paper money and other numismatic items?
Well, in my day, I don't think anybody faked coins or put mint marks on coins. Condition was, you know, whether things had been cleaned, washed, and so on, was the issue. But, you know, I see stories in Coin World about things being faked now. And I think the value of a good expert in coins are the images in his or her head of seeing so many genuine ones that when you see something that's wrong, it jumps out. You know, In the autograph world, dealers used to say, well, I just know it's wrong, or I just know it's genuine. And I won a court case on the basis of explaining in detail how you just know it, because you have 300 images of something that they all have similar characteristics in patina, feel, and then one thing stands out. And so you say it's wrong. And it's not just the quick decision, it's because you have all of this built in your head. But you also have to look at things and not be part of the psychology of a fraud, because you want it to be genuine. So you lean, in that area, that's where you're weak. And that's what you really have to look at and question everything. There were a series of Elvis Presley manuscripts that came up, and a number of dealers offered them to me at an antiquarian book fair. And for the first time, I really wanted this stuff to be genuine, because I was going to keep them. These were the songs that Elvis sang when I was a kid. And I was really rooting for these to be genuine. And I was so disappointed when I concluded it was a hoax, that instead of just pulling the plug, I wanted to see the forger or person behind it, I think they're all the same person, twisting in the wind as long as possible. So I kept the case open, and it was great. He was in the Netherlands. Suddenly his English got really poor, and in explaining, he gave too much detail about the provenance. And I told him, I said, I can't really understand your English anymore. So write to me in German. No, he didn't want to do that. He wanted to keep it in English. I mean, he was being careful at that point. He didn't know what to say. But I was mad and disappointed. But I was really skeptical. And that was a case of he gave too much information. Something like that, a whole bunch of Elvis Presley turn up. You want to know where it came from and the circumstance, but he gave me so much to work with. And he didn't account in his planning for the fact that the Elvis Mafia was all still alive. And Graceland put me in touch with everybody. And I mean, the classic was on these manuscripts, it said, Liz, type this up, Elvis. Well, I found Liz, who told me Elvis never called her Liz. Her name was Elizabeth. He always called her Elizabeth. And she knows that she never saw these. He put too much in there. I think he didn't expect that somebody would really track it all down.
So it sounds like a lot of times people who are trying to deceive will fill in the blanks, so to speak. But as you were mentioning earlier, though, in the discussion of this, that you really wanted this to be because of, your connection to the songs of Elvis. How much does emotion become a burden when you're trying to do the work that you're doing?
I think Elvis was almost the only thing where I had a stake in it. Normally, however it comes out is how it comes out. And putting aside personal opinions, and that was really the case with Richard Nixon. I took that on, and I knew that I would be unemotional. I knew I would look at things for what they were. And I ended up having a better opinion of Nixon, which I never expected. I had listened to the radio constantly during Watergate. We were all rooting on that Saturday night when he fired everybody. We thought he was going down. But that didn't matter. It also didn't matter that people said to me, why in the world was I doing a job for Richard Nixon? And it had nothing to do with it. And I got a much more complex view of Nixon and a positive view of his ideas, because they were right there in his handwriting, which would slope down badly as the evening went on and he got drunk. And I related the story of being taken over to the building that, where he would go to write at night. And the Secret Service agent who took me over there said that he was one of the regulars who helped Nixon get back because he would be so drunk every night. Nixon was a guy full of demons, and he was complex, but I couldn't like him. I had met him socially. There was nothing there to like. I mean, he wasn't like Ronald Reagan, who was highly likable. My emotions were there, but I really set them aside. And a lot of these appraisals, you run into people, family members that you don't like, but it really doesn't have anything to do with it. You have to be impartial.
So I want to ask, as the clock ticks down less than 3 minutes to go, one final question, because letters and paper documents have formed such an integral part of your life. What, if anything, are future historians losing by the transition to digital communication for so much of modern life?
I think they're losing everything. You know, maybe with interviews on Zoom, you get to see the person and you get to see body language, but you no longer see emotions in the handwriting, and there really are big differences. And it doesn't take a lot of experience to see the emotion that somebody's putting into their writing. I think you're left with a final product. Whereas if you have original manuscripts of a book or an article, you can see how the author reworked it, other things that they considered. And in a lot of cases, you could do research with an original manuscript into how the author came to those ideas. You know, what got crossed out, what got added. And I think it's just gone. You know, that ability, you don't even get a disc, but you keep rewriting. The corrections aren't saved anyway. So I think an enormous amount is lost, and people don't write. I'm told kids can't read handwriting.
Yeah, cursive.
And they print things.
Absolutely. That's my experience. I do have to say we have less than a minute to go. Thank you so much for joining us today for this. There's so many great stories in this book. I can't recommend it enough to folks out there listening, Safeguarding History. Kenneth Rendell, thank you again.
Thank you. You're a nice connection to the first edition of Coin World that I have.
And that was our interview with Kenneth Rendell, author of Safeguarding History, Trailblazing Adventures Inside the Worlds of Collecting and Forging History. What a treat, and what a great book. Lots of, you just get a sense that this is the guy who's really gotten to know people, famous people, done some amazing things, not just as clients, but as friends. Put together library for Bill and Melinda Gates. He's done all sorts of lecturing, and this is his ninth book, third, I think, for Whitman. One was on the American West, and another was on World War II. He was involved in the World War II Museum. Just so many cool things. It's You got to check it out. It's a delight for a history lover.
Yeah, and like you said, so many cool things. We only scratched the surface in the amount of time we spent with the author. We only scratched the surface. There's so much more there for you, depending upon what your interest may be. You'll find, you know, if you something in a chapter doesn't quite resonate with you, turn a few pages. You'll find something in the next chapter for sure. I mean, it's well worth getting. Make sure you pick up your copy as quickly as you can.
Absolutely. So we are going to let the interview and our words speak for themselves in regard to this now, and get you on down the road to your next adventure. In the meantime,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.